Hey everybody, and welcome to episode 7 of Tech Tree with my fellow procrastinators. Hey there, Shubham.
Hey, Chirag, and hello to all our listeners.
And hello, Partha.
Hey guys, hey, Chirag and Shubham, what's up?
So, on today's episode, we're going to be talking a little bit about security. We also have our first Ask Tech Tree question, so isn't that exciting? And that's what we're going to begin with. Judy Presetio. And if I got your name wrong, I'm really sorry. Send us a follow-up question from episode 4, where we talked about smartphones. And I quote, one of my criteria of smartphones to buy is to make sure it has a removable battery. Do you think manufacturers will continue to produce high-end phones with user-removable batteries? Why? Shubham, do you want to take this first?
Sure. I don't think, unfortunately, manufacturers will continue to produce high-end phones with removable batteries. A couple of reasons why. Everyone keeps saying that the argument is waterproofing, and here's what happens. This is my opinion. With different brands, they try and outdo each other. So if your competitor has waterproofed his phone enough so that it can, you know, last for a couple of cycles in a puddle or in a washing machine or whatever abuse these phones go through.
I'm sorry, a moment to, I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you right there. Did you just say washing machine?
Yeah,
I started laughing because his examples are very specific. So it was like a puddle or a washing machine. And I was like, okay.
Follow-up question, have you ever put a phone into the washing machine?
No, but I clearly you guys don't know enough people, clumsy people. I know a lot of clumsy people that have put phones in washing machines. I didn't know that this was a new thing. I thought everybody sort of did that, considering that these guys did it. Clearly,
moment of silence for phones that went into the washing machine. A moment of silence.
Point was, because human beings are going to be human beings, it's probably mostly to do with the fact that they need these phones to be waterproof to a degree. Removable covers, it causes an issue on that front. High-end phones definitely need to be waterproof to a degree. I mean, there's videos of Sony basically putting one of their latest flagship phones inside a glass of water and then getting it to play music. And if you're a high-end manufacturer, when you're competing with that, you're competing with Samsung and all these guys, you need that. Having said that, I think to the low entry level, maybe even to the mid-end, maybe, it could be a USP in certain countries where people don't have access to a lot of electricity and during the day, and maybe they prefer having, you know, two charged up batteries and to have an alternative. The other also reason I think now is because of the advent of power banks. Removable batteries have just become a thing of the past. You take your power bank, you charge multiple devices with it, and you top your phone off that way. There's literally no need now to replace it. Thirdly, the other reason why someone would want to replace their batteries after a certain number of cycles, your cell phone's basically not going to last you for the whole day because the battery basically gets a bit weaker over time. By the time those time frames roll around, it's already been a year or 2 years, and most people, especially with high-end phones, most people move on to the next phone by that time. So when you sort of combine all these three factors, removable batteries, unfortunately, I think are on their way out.
Shubham, how do you feel about that? Like, do you care? Does it matter?
It used to matter. I think there was a time where it used to matter. With lithium ion batteries, I think it stopped mattering. We've come to a point where, honestly, I would tell you this, if I didn't have a power bank or something good, like I use an Anker power bank, they're amazing. And they charge my phone and like 40 minutes to about an hour and a half. And it sort of has eliminated the need for me to even think about it. So just the fact that I don't think about changing or replacing batteries in a phone is enough for me to say, all right, for me, this issue is passed. And I think that's the case with a lot of people.
I just wanted to add a point from the manufacturer's perspective as well. You know, I think, Shubham, you've already touched on the fact that I think lithium-ion batteries have improved drastically, right? You know, there used to be a time, I think, when these batteries, like the lifetime of these batteries was not even close to the lifetime. They were good enough to last a couple of years or 3 years or whatever. I mean, actually back then, I mean, pre-smartphone days, our phones used to last probably 4 or 5 years. But, you know, the batteries weren't good enough to last that long. So you kind of, you know, during a user's smartphone lifetime, you just had to have the option to hold charge for all of an hour and almost render the phone unusable. From a manufacturer's point of view, I mean, having the supply chain of having battery service and production of batteries and making sure they reach everywhere the smartphone is reached and stuff. These are all costly things. They all take a lot of time. And so, a lot of money as well, right? So I think that now that the batteries have reached this point where, the average battery easily takes you through to 2 years. Yes, sure. I mean, we can make the argument we have, I think, in the past already that I still have to charge it more than once a day, or it doesn't last me an entire day, but it's not unusable, right? Even a slightly old battery lasts half a day, a few hours, and so considering that, it just makes sense for a manufacturer to say, okay, then I can limit the spare battery production at my stores or the minimum places, because remember that all the waterproofing, everything included, right? Like, these batteries are replaceable. They do get replaced. It's just it's not just a user replaceable battery. You have to actually take it in. You have to get someone to do it for you. So in those odd cases, and I think those percentages are very small now for most people, I think with the high-end phones, I mean, the cell phone replacement these days is a couple of years. It's not even, they don't even take it to three half the time. Awesome. So, thank you, Judy, for that question. Obviously, if you guys have questions about stuff we talk about, stuff we don't talk about, or anything generally related to tech, you can send them to us on Twitter by reaching us at TechTree, which is T3CHTRE. And also, you can leave us a comment on the episode webpage as well. So we're going to talk about Careem's security breach. For those of you who don't know, Careem is an on-demand taxi service. Our local version in some ways of Uber. So Careem last week posted that they had identified a security breach that had happened on and before Jan 14th this year. User data had been accessed during this breach, or at least the hackers that managed to get into the systems had accessed all of the user data and all of the captain, or what they call the driver data, that had existed up to that point. So while Careem themselves did not release any numbers, the reports around this were in the papers, announced that Careem had about 14 million user accounts and some 550,000 captain or driver user accounts have been affected. Now, Careem themselves also mentioned that they have not seen that this data, or they are not aware of any incidents that have arisen out of the misuse of this data yet, but that they were doing this just to inform everybody that the breach had existed, that people should change their passwords and just be aware of this and report any suspicious transactions and other things that they might notice with their accounts, emails, and all of that. Some trip data is also said to have existed on the system, so this was also accessible. And the last point is simply that, as is the case with most applications here and around the world, due to the compliance that they have to do with the certification called the PCI, which exists for credit cards, Careem did not store credit cards on their own servers, so it was stored with their payment gateways. No credit card data has apparently been accessed so far. So, in light of that, Partha, let's start with you this time. Initial thoughts?
So the first thing that I actually want to point out is that it actually took them 3 months to identify, isolate, and actually report to the public. I mean, I think as a consumer-facing brand, they could have come out a little earlier and said that there is work under progress and we have detected this. But then they've also gone ahead to mention on the blog that, they wanted to be absolutely certain before they shared anything with the public that there was anything wrong. I just think that the approach could have been a little more, to me personally, 3 months is a lot of time, and a lot could have gone wrong in those 3 months. As users, if there was anything that could have been affected, I mean, they very clearly mentioned that they haven't seen any misuse. But if they had kind of blocked it at the beginning, they should have just said, this is the initial investigation, this is what we have kind of seen, and this is what you should do, even as precautionary measures, just initially. And we will keep you posted of what happens in the future. I think that would have probably given me a little more peace. I'm not saying that I'm unhappy with what they've done. I mean, they've shared what they feel is necessary for a consumer to feel comfortable with having their data on their servers. Again, this data is not anything that they haven't put on any other website. It's a neither here nor there kind of situation for me in terms of the data that this guy, the hackers, have got. The source of the information, I don't know. They haven't been very clear as to how they found out, what they did. They've been very vague about the entire process, and I think that they could definitely be clearer in terms of how they've addressed the breach and what it really entails for the end consumer.
So I've been ever since this news broke, I've kind of been looking at, a ton of the reactions, primarily on social media, but otherwise regarding this incident. And a majority of the people pretty much echoed what you just said, which is, why did you wait so long? As someone that has worked with systems on the other side and stuff, I understand why the information could not have been made public immediately. That's normal practice. This is how it's done. You don't want to reveal until you've had a handle on whatever the exposure could be. And when I say that, I mean, what could have been used to accomplish the breach, right? Making sure that you don't sort of go public with that information and suddenly, everybody else is trying while you're still busy patching systems. So the fact that there is a delay is understandable. That being said, I do agree with you, though, that 3 months seems very long. And in fact, the one crucial factor for me that makes me really wonder about the 3 months is the fact that Karim says that this happened on and before January 14th. And that if you created any account with Karim after January 14th, your data was not affected. It tells me that means the hackers no longer had access to the situation as of Jan 14. So then it does make me wonder, why did it take 3.5 months after that to inform us by saying, well, we were trying to get a handle on things, but according to you, you've had a handle on things since January 15th.
So what happened to the data that was put in there before that? I mean, what did they get? What did they do? Is something that is very
no. So that's the thing. And to some extent, it's not exactly the easiest thing to figure out. And I'll tell you why. Simply because a lot of times, partially because of the way the systems are designed, partially because of the way logs are written and these kind of things, right? Not necessarily everything is known. So they could have known, for example, that hey, someone made a copy of the database, but then you don't know specifically within that individually what has been accessed, what hasn't been accessed, right? Which is why the scope of this quote-unquote breach is that the entire user span up to, as the day was, and which is why this number has come out, right? This 14 million users, the 14 million user accounts that we're talking about is the number of user accounts Karim had as of January 14th.
Well, the other question that I have is that what is the extent of the breach in the sense that what regions have been affected and why were only those regions targeted? Now, I'm assuming that they took 3 months to investigate what happened and who did what.
That's how it's been described, yes. I will link to Karim's own post and the news report like in the show notes for anybody that wants to go and read this.
That is the critical information that I would like in terms of clarity of thought, saying, okay, you know what? The reason we took 3 months to figure out what happened was because we were trying to isolate the situation to ABC region and it happened because of ABC person for whatever reason. I don't want to know what the thought was behind the breach. I want to know who have been affected.
What is the real extent of the data that has been breached?
Exactly, the extent of the damage. I mean, right now, when they say 14 million, I'm assuming every single user on Karim has been affected, which includes me, you, and Shaban.
So I'm going to shed some light on this. First of all, before obviously we get started, hindsight is 2020. Everyone needs to acknowledge that, especially when it comes to security. And I think Karim is doing a bang-up job. I like Karim as a platform. I prefer them over Uber. I think the team in Dubai, in generally, I don't have anything bad to say about them. I actually have had very positive experiences with Karim. Having said that, obviously, when a breach like this happens, fingers are pointed. Even though we're a Dubai-based podcast, I think it's important to understand that in this case, a breach may not necessarily have happened in Dubai.
Yeah.
Karim is spread across 13 different countries. Maybe the breach could have happened somewhere else and the network could have been compromised somewhere else. I'm going to preface this by saying this. Unless Karim officially releases a statement, all of this is hearsay. It's basically one person's word against another person's word. Even what's written in the newspaper could also, I mean, I'm not saying the reporters did a bad job, but it could be misinterpreted. That's the nature of security. It's a very technical field. Unless you are talking to someone who's directly involved with the breach or directly involved with the team that's hacked and caused the problem to begin with, it's going to be very hard for people to say concisely, hey, this is what happened, this is how it was done, and this is who is at fault. So a little bit of digging has revealed a couple of things that there's a company called Security Wall. They're based in Pakistan, and they basically put a little blog post out which says that we're white hat hackers, as apparently that's what they are. They're security researchers, as they like to call themselves. And they occasionally will look at major platforms and test them to see if there's any bugs there that they can exploit. And then they reach out to those platforms who eventually probably then hire them to fix said bugs that have been found. Maybe that's how they run their business. I'm not a security guy, but I'm assuming that's kind of how it works with white hat hackers. When Careem became big, they decided to turn their attention to it, to their platform, and they found some vulnerabilities. So there was a guy named Daniel Nasser who basically emailed them saying that, well, look, I'm writing to notify you that we found the following issues with your systems. And this person claimed that he was able to access 1.4 million customer confidential information. That includes things like, you know, drivers' emails, names, mobile numbers. He was only referring to drivers in his email. My point was, at the end of the day, that he did reach out to them. He got an auto response, and security wall then go on and say in their blog post that that was, you know, they didn't really officially hear back from Careem, and they sort of moved on. What's important to note is that the date on this blog post is June 16, 2017. It is long ago. The blog post then goes on to say that, hey, you know, it's disappointing for us because Careem then supposedly fixed some of those breaches and didn't really give us any credit or reach back to us and say thank you or anything, which is fine. It's up to Careem to do what they want. They're not obligated. But my point was, if you've realized that there's been a security problem, have a talk with the guys that are in charge of that division. Again, this is not blaming the organization, but there needs to be some sort of system that says, hey, if we're getting a high level update or flag from a security researching company, I would put that pretty damn high on the priority list, let alone not responding to them. In fact, I would respond to them and see if what we can address it and what else is there that's sort of hanging out there in the air with no backup. There's an interesting point that was put forward by Omar Qasim from Jarrapato fame, and he said that after a platform becomes big enough, you get so many bug reports that it's really, really hard. Like I said, hindsight being 2020, it's easy for us to say, hey, you know, we could prioritize this. And I'm sure now that things have gone this way, Careem will probably put in some sort of framework that would ensure that this never happens again. It's one of those things where security in this region, unfortunately, does not get patched till shit hits the fan. And there's become a sort of a culture over here where in the IT industry, and it's unfortunately a saying that I've heard in many, many places. And the saying is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. People aren't proactive, and then they line up in hot soup.
I want to actually add a little point here. I'm reading the blog and actually a little bit of a report that was actually released in Pakistan based on the blog post and a follow-up sort of situation to the entire Careem thing. One thing that really caught my eye is that the hackers actually hacked Careem Pakistan first in June. Essentially, what this means is that in June or July or whenever, sometime in that time frame, there was a breach that was very localized in nature. Now, at that point, if Careem did not pull up its socks and was not able to kind of do something about it,
guys, I mean, I just want to step in because I think for perspective. Look, I mean, I'm completely agreeing with you, Shaban. I have a lot to say about some of the points you made, right, regarding the state of security and how people approach it here, and I'm in agreement with that. But you know, there is as of this moment, and I'm not saying that I have conclusive proof otherwise either. But we don't know that the same vulnerability has resulted in this breach today, right? We're speculating that Careem had some issue back in June last year, and then today we've got this breach, and it doesn't necessarily imply causality there, you know.
But Chirag, let me correct you. That I already prefaced when I started, I said that you can't blame Careem because these sort of security issues, they're very technical, and unless you're speaking directly with the hackers or you're speaking directly with someone who is very in the know on what happened from Careem officially, everything else is just conjecture. I've already said that, and I agree with you.
Let me put my disclaimer in there as well, just for security purposes. So basically, I'm not saying I know what went on behind the scenes. I'm just saying that if there was even the slightest idea of what Careem knew was coming towards them, they could have A, taken the right kind of steps, and B, not have wait for 3 months before they said things were under control.
Yeah, and I think that is one of the bigger issues as well, yeah.
And I think those are the two really big points, because they are dealing with consumer data, and I just think that, you know, they've been a little lax in terms of trying to get the word out, saying that, you know what, you are the region that you've been affected, and this is what has hurt us. We understand that you guys are a consumer of our services. we're sorry, we're doing this. You know, a little more clarity in terms of what they did and how they went about it would be really, really appreciated. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, since they put this announcement, I mean, I've been sort of monitoring the news and social media. Kareem has just continued to say the same thing in many ways. And to everybody that replied saying, why did you wait 3 months? Typically, the answer has been and continues to be, you know, we wanted to get a handle on everything. I'm not saying that Kareem hasn't done enough. I think they are doing what they can to make sure that we understand that it exists, which is great. I mean, it's nice that, from everything that we can see as of now, Kareem has done this proactively, right? I'm personally happy to see that they're the ones that have reached out. The reason we're having this discussion even is because they've informed us rather than someone hacked the data and revealed it, right? It's because Kareem has come out and said, hey, this is what happened. And I think that's a great thing. That's a good line of action, and that's what we would expect consumer-facing companies to do. But for me, like, I'm going to kind of repeat that point here, is that when Kareem says that as of Jan 15, if you create an account, you were not breached, that tells me that they had a handle on it, if they are able to say that with that authority. And then the 3 months kind of is tough to explain. A little while, a couple of weeks, maybe a month, sure, but 3 months is a bit tough to explain.
Okay. We have to talk about what we as users can do about it. I mean, I'm not entirely happy about the fact that my data could essentially be out there, even if it's ride sharing data and doesn't personally identify me, which in this case it may or may not. We don't know. What do you think, having experience in enterprise security, what would you recommend as a couple of steps that we as users can do to protect ourselves?
In most cases, as has happened in the case of Kareem as well, you know, it is generally good practice, it's established practice that people don't store passwords in plain text. And what that means is companies that generally have your details don't actually store your passwords in the form that you write them in, right? So if you write your password as password 123, and I must put a disclaimer here, please don't ever use that as a password. In case you look at the company's database, you know, your password won't actually say password 123. You'll see a string of letters and numbers. And this process is known as hashing, where they basically, you know, apply an algorithm that converts your password from password 123 into something else, right? It tends to be a one-way process, which means that if someone has that string, they can't actually figure out what the original word is, which is a good thing, and that's obviously it's a happy thing, because that means that, you know, you are a little bit more protected. However, because there are some established ways to hash, there are other things that get involved. I think one of the biggest things that I always advise people is please don't use the same passwords everywhere as far as is possible. Now, this is, this is something that actually this online pervasiveness has caused for us as users, where we're just, you know, we have accounts with just so many services, right? That it becomes harder and harder for us to maintain different passwords. And so, you know, I see this a lot. I see a lot of people doing this. They have one password that they use. Invariably, it has some personal identifying information in the password itself, right? So people use birthdays. They use birthdays of spouses, family, whatever else. And then they use the same thing everywhere. And this is where it's tricky, because tomorrow when something might get hacked, or some service, you know, fails to protect it, or in some inadvertent way reveals your password. Now, this password can be reused across multiple systems, and you might find that people might get, you know, access to more than one system just by knowing one password. So this is where it's pretty dangerous. For people that are then, you know, have this issue where they're like, okay, well, this is too many passwords, how do I keep coming up with different combinations? I think it is a good idea to look at password managers. You know, there are some third-party ones available out there. iOS users and Apple users have their own inbuilt password manager as well. I really recommend you use it, because what it at least does for you is it helps you generate a new random password that's not linked to you directly in terms of the actual text, you know, for each service that you have. And so for you, then it's a matter of remembering one master password that you can make much more complicated, which is what I do. But then at least your different services are using some very, very differentiated passwords, which kind of helps the situation.
And to add to this, here's the technique that I use. First of all, the way I approach this sort of situation is I know that my password is stored in the browser, or stored here or there, or some third party provider, whether it's hashed or not. But I usually know that it's just an eventuality before it gets leaked. I've come up with my own mental system on how I deal with passwords. So I have a sort of a complex password relatively, but I also add a string that is related to the service that I'm using that password on. So my password for Facebook would be, the string would be something to do with Facebook, and that gets added to the master string. When you combine the two things, that's my password for Facebook. And when I use another service, I apply the same logic where I have something to do with the name of the website and I incorporate that into the password, and then that becomes my password for that website. And therefore, I don't necessarily have to use a password keeper, because I always worry that, hey, what if the password manager gets broken into? Then, you know, we're all messed up. It'll be even more messed up. And this sort of keeps me ultimately agile. I think we've become too complacent right now. We're too used to having everything done for us. If it's a matter of remembering 5 or 6 strings, which are a variation of one another, I think that's fairly easy to do. And we should be able to do it. We should at least keep it in our heads, because at the end of the day, right now, our heads are still the most secure place for now.
You know, we should add over here that please don't write your passwords down and stick them on a sticky note on your monitors.
Yeah, people still do that. And again, winding this discussion down, basically, it is a matter of time before there's a security breach somewhere and your information is stolen. So you just have to work out a way where you can minimize it. So how can they use it? Can they be used against you? Don't, again, put out too much there that you're not willing to part ways with, or and it doesn't affect you deeply. A lot of people do interesting things. They will use like a secondary email address for pretty much all the shit stuff. And then they use that in spam services, and that way they limit the impact. And they keep a main email address and they never ever give it out. It just goes out to very, very select few people.
So there are services that help you generate, you know, randomized emails just to subscribe to things that you might want to without having to use your own email. You know, Gmail allows you to add the plus sign and then any random string to your email, and it still will be received by you. So you can always do your email plus, you know, name of service at gmail.com, for example, and then you use that to subscribe to the service so that it becomes easy for you later on to sort of sidestep that. So for example, if you don't want to be, you know, you want to be done with that service, you don't want that service to contact you any further, you can actually send any emails received to that, you know, your name plus Facebook, for example, and just dump it away. And the one thing I'm going to say as well, be very careful about how your services are linked to each other. Just as an example, I mean, if your Facebook is linked to a certain email and then, you know, that same email is also linked to your bank and your other services and what have you. That means you're, you know, you're on a single point of failure, as we call it, which is essentially that all someone needs to do with you is get access to that email account, and then they'll be able to reset just about any service. And I think that that's something that you should be aware of. These days, we're logged into our emails everywhere. I think it's super important, you know, that you don't link all your services to just the one email, that the moment that email is breached, you know, you're kind of done for.
And I think it will also be remiss if we didn't cover two-factor authentication. I've started using two-factor authentication recently with a lot of my services. And even though it can be a little tiresome sometimes, it does have its convenience and its value when you do have a security breach. Because every other day I get like a message from Facebook, hey, here's your password reset code. Because I know someone's like messing around and trying to get in. And I get that quite a bit. It's almost every week or every 2 weeks. But because I have two-factor authentication enabled, everything has to go through my cell phone and my immediate interaction with my cell phone.
Yeah, and so, you know, in case you're wondering, what that basically means is that in addition to your password, you might be sent a text code. Sometimes there are code generators that services like Gmail and even Facebook uses to verify that you are actually you, because not only do you need to know your password, but then you also need access to your phone. And these are two things, and hence two factors. A lot of services today, Facebook included, Twitter, all of these services, they've all activated it. And I think it's super important. If you're using an application, if you're using a service that has it activated, right, it'll take you 10 extra seconds to log in, but at least you know that every login is going to be secure. You know, you get alerted that, hey, someone tried, you know, got halfway through and didn't make it all the way, or someone is trying to get into your account. I mean, turn on these alerts. I know they're sometimes you might feel like that's a lot, but I think in this day and age, it's something we should absolutely do. I get alerted when I'm logging into Facebook from a different location, right? But that's important, because it means this. I know that that's me, and I know I can set that aside. If you're not sure about something, or you're unclear about how something works, you know, you can always shoot us a tweet. Just you know, send it to @techtree. That's T3CHTRE. Or you can, you know, message one of us individually. And Siobhan, if you want to just share where people can reach you.
So you can reach me on Twitter, and my Twitter handle is @airspective. That's AIRSBECTIV.
Partha, if you just want to tell us where people can reach out to you.
So I'm reachable on Twitter as ParthaNS. You can look me up on Google as Partha Srinivasan or ParthaNS. Either way is fine. P-A-R-T-H-A-N-S. That's how you spell it. Feel free to reach out to me for any questions that you may have regarding consumer or enterprise technology, and I'm happy to answer them for you.
You're going
to
be at the show in tech this weekend?
Absolutely. It's an event that I've been planning for a while now, and I really look forward to hosting you guys. Feel free to drop by. Again, reach out to me, and I'm happy to answer any questions regarding show in tech.
Awesome. And it's going to be at the Knowledge Park, right?
Show in Tech is going to be hosted at In5 in Dubai Knowledge Park. If you look up In5 Tech on Google Maps, you'll be able to find the location really easily. We're going to be there from 10 o'clock onwards. We're going to have close to about 20 DIY project teams that we'll be showcasing, and we're expecting over 100 guests to come in across the entire day. So it's going to be pretty exciting to see how the community, how they're using all these cool exponential technologies and building concepts around them. It's going to be pretty interesting.
So that's on Saturday, May the 5th, right?
That's right, Saturday, May 5th, 10 o'clock onwards. Feel free to join us.
Awesome. I'm available on Twitter at ChiragND. That's ChiragND. If you're a Micro.blog blog user, you can find me at Chirag. That's at Chirag. You can find information, show notes, links to stuff we talked about at techtree.show/7. That's it from us from this episode. We'll be back soon.